Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Chris Mooney. Chris is the author of The Republican War on Science, and he blogs a very popular blog at chrismooney.com. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks. It's actually chriscmooney.com.
Chris C. Mooney, that's right. chriscmooney.com. It's a very popular blog, and you've been covering the topics that you've been writing about in The Republican War on Science. You actually first came to my attention about 4 years ago when you started to write in The American Prospect online about the President's Council on Bioethics, which is, I hope, a topic that's still of interest to you.
Yeah, although there's been some new news there that I've been on book tour and haven't even been able to keep up.
About Pellegrino.
Right.
Are you going to write something about Pellegrino?
As soon as I'm able to get up to speed, perhaps.
Okay, good. Because, yeah, he's got an equally interesting ideological trajectory, especially in the wake of the ascension of the new pope, the fact that we have a new Catholic in charge of American bioethics. Well, the Republican war on science has just been huge these last couple of weeks. You have the miracle of timing with this thing.
Well, maybe miracle timing. Maybe I've struck a chord. I mean, let's face it. Scientists are outraged by the Bush administration. They feel that the administration has given them the back of the hand, and not just on matters of funding of science, scientific research, although they're unhappy about that. But about what bothers them more, I think, are these kind of integrity of science issues where it's clear that that science is being misused or abused on subjects ranging from global climate change to embryonic stem cell research.
I was really shocked when I was doing some research on this topic related to the writing that you were doing, when I ran across the statistic that there had been a dramatic decline in the percentage of not only scientists, but also PhDs involved in the Bush administration. They're coming from a totally different part of the policymaking universe where academic expertise and intellectual knowledge isn't appreciated.
Sure. I mean, I think that's part of, I don't know the study to which you're referring, but it kind of fits what I'm talking about. So I'm assuming it's right, which is that the federal government today, federal agencies, which are often charged with using science to do their job, so EPA, for example, or FDA, you know, these are science-based agencies, they've got political appointees in there, and these political appointees are doing something different, which is they're listening to the interest groups they're trained to listen to. And in this case, when it comes to the abuse of science, it seems to be particularly religious conservatives and regulated industry are getting the spin on science that they want again and again and again. And that's why it's such a sweeping problem, because these groups are interested in so many different areas, and it seems that they all often get what they want.
The climate issue, of course, is one that everyone's pretty aware of at this point, where the Bush administration's out of step not only with most of the nations around the world, but also with most climatologists. And New Orleans has brought that into sharp relief.
Yes.
Now, I know that the responsible thing to say is that New Orleans is not linkable to global climate change, but there is a study out this week that says that there has been a dramatic increase in level 4 and 5 hurricanes in the last 2 decades.
It's the second study.
A second study that says that?
No, this is the second study in recent months that's come out in a major scientific journal to, in essence, reach that conclusion.
So even if this one wasn't, in general, we're going to have more of these.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that kind of fits the global warming theory, right? Which is that, you know, you warm the ocean water, which is a necessary consequence of global warming, then the ocean water is what fuels the storms. So it makes sense on a theoretical level as well. And now we've got papers that are coming out that seem to be actually providing the evidence to back the theory. So, you know, the hurricane climate connection is very much on the table right now. We do have to be careful and observe that we cannot link Hurricane Katrina, or can we say that there's not a link? We just can't say. So
not only is it that the Bush administration cut back on levee building and cut back on, and screwed up FEMA and appointed incompetence there and then didn't respond in a timely fashion, but they also may be contributing in a global way to the increasing severity of these kinds of storms.
Or at least neglecting to deal with the problem.
Exactly.
And but you know, their real abuse, their real offense on global warming, I mean, from a policy perspective, if this is something you care about, you might want to disagree with their policy, which is no mandatory measures to cap greenhouse gas emissions. From my perspective, I'm more worried about the abuse of science, and I'm in an agree-to-disagree position about policy. So I'm most outraged about the fact that they are actually involved in distorting the science in order to justify their position of inaction, at least opposition to mandatory caps. And you can see that again and again in the Bush administration. They're playing games with the information itself.
And what you document is that there was a clear mapped out strategy of the energy industry that the Bush administration so closely tied to set up their own science shops and their own spokespeople in the scientific community.
Right. I mean, it's quite clear that there are a number of think tanks, largely on the conservative side, that are collectively contributing to an atmosphere of doubt about climate science. And that atmosphere of doubt is really skewing the mainstream scientific position and undermining it. And I think that it's clear that this is not an accident.
And as you've pointed out, that takes advantage of the fact that scientists are by nature tentative. It's a culture of critical discourse. They never want to say, well, I've absolutely proved this for all time.
Right. And they won't tell you it's 100% certain that the mainstream scientific consensus on global warming, which is that humans are causing it, or that we need to invoke human causes to explain the temperature trends that we're seeing, the increasing temperatures. You won't, I don't think, you will find a scientist who will say that this is now 100% certain. You will find them saying that it is very likely to be right. And that language, very likely, is what's used to signify a scientific conclusion that is quite firm. But we never reach the point of certainty.
Your family was in New Orleans, or New Orleanians. Have they been able to get back home and find out what happened?
No, they have not gone back to New Orleans yet, and I'm kind of urging them not to. I don't know that the city is really ready to handle people yet, and it kind of seems dangerous to me to go back at this point.
Yeah.
So no, they have not gone back. I assume that they will at some point.
Well, our best to them. I'm speaking with Chris Mooney. He's the author of The Republican War on Science, and you can find his blog at Chris C. Mooney. That's MOONEY.com. And fascinating blog it is. Another issue that you talk about in the book and on your blog, which is of great interest to our listenership, is the stem cell issue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here the issue is not so much a distortion of the science, although that happens on occasion as well, but it's this an actual clampdown on a policy of clampdown on actual research and funding of research.
Well, I would kind of disagree slightly. I actually think that the misuse of science, the actual science, I don't like the Bush policy either, personally. But I think that the policy itself has been justified by a fundamental misuse of science, which is the president's false claim about the existence of more than 60 embryonic stem cell lines.
Which are only 17 now?
I believe the latest number is 22. But you got to talk to scientists and you say, are these 22 lines, can you get them when you research them? Are they useful, et cetera? And then the number shrinks even more from a scientific utility standpoint. So there are really very little stem cell lines available for federal funding under the policy. Bush misrepresented that.
Is the non-funding of stem cell science in the United States the reason why South Koreans and other countries are moving ahead?
Well, I think that we have to be careful. I mean, there's probably a lot of reasons that they're moving ahead. But the politics, the politicization of this issue, which has contributed to hesitancy among scientists, and which has itself been supported by misuses of science, I think it clearly is not helping the matter. So I think that, yeah, we're falling behind, at least in part, because of the politics.
So the Christian right, on the one hand, is a group of interests that have a interest in certain kinds of scientific policies, and then the corporate interests have interest in other kinds of scientific policies.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the two principal groups out there that you see distorting the use of objective science in federal policy.
Right, from the right. You know, and it's not to say that there aren't groups that might distort science from the left. So maybe environmentalists have occasionally been guilty of this, to use an example on the left. But of course, they're not really... their buddies are not in power at the moment.
Yeah, I suspect that your analysis would have looked a little bit different if you'd been doing it in the European Parliament or something.
True. And, you know, I don't want to let the left off the hook. And if people look through the things I've written in the past, there have been a number of science policy pieces where I have rebuked the left very specifically. For example, I was very displeased with members of the academic left signing petitions to oppose therapeutic cloning research, for example. And I was pretty hard on them in an article about that for in the American Prospect a while back. But clearly, you know, these people are not running the show, and the abuse of science by government and by an administration that's in power is much more egregious. And I actually think, furthermore, that the Republican Party today is more inclined to misuse science than the Democratic Party for reasons that we can get into. But it does centrally come back to these two interest groups, religious conservatives getting what they want, big business getting what they want, rolling together. It's kind of the perfect storm.
This is really part of the shift within the Republican Party away from the old Rockefeller Republicans, like Vannevar Bush was a Republican who founded the National Science Foundation.
And Eisenhower, you know, brought scientists into the White House, Thomas Sputnik.
Right. And so you have this alliance of petty bourgeois, small-minded corporate interests, and then this Christian right element that's very different from the other kinds of Republicans.
Sure, that's the party today. And, you know, when I title my book The Republican War on Science, I don't want anyone to think that I'm condemning these remaining moderate or Rockefeller Republicans. Rather, I'm denouncing a party infrastructure in a way that a party does business and a party leadership. And the institution itself of the Republican Party today, which is not run by moderates, but is indeed run by the conservative movement.
Another thing that happened recently was this official in the National Institutes of Health, I believe, resigned over Plan B. Can you tell
us
that?
That was actually the FDA.
FDA. What happened?
Sure. Well, the Plan B contraception is just yet another classic case study of how science is misused in the Bush administration in order to humor the political goals of an interest group, in this case, Christian conservatives. So let me give you a little background here so you can see why this person resigned. Her name is Susan Wood, and she's an expert on sort of women's health drugs. Now, Plan B is emergency contraception, the so-called morning after pill. It was already available by prescription, and the FDA was then set to consider whether to make it more widely available over the counter. And this, of course, would make sense because its effectiveness declines steeply the longer you wait to use it. So this is a drug that you want to make more widely available because it will prevent unwanted pregnancies and presumably abortions too. The Scientific Advisory Committee voted 23-4 in favor of approval, just staggering. And the FDA experts were on that page as well. And yet the FDA decided to cook up a quasi-scientific rationale for delaying approval. And the rationale was, oh, we need more data on younger adolescents. And of course, they hadn't set this, you know, this test for other drugs. And that data is exceedingly hard to collect and probably unethical to collect, right? You don't want to study younger adolescent girls with emergency contraception. So it was kind of setting a scientific trap, and that's how that played out. And, of course, they still managed to delay. They've put off the decision for well over a year now.
You've been pretty busy this last week, but you may have seen this study that came out, I think it was from the National Institute of Health Statistics, on American sexual behavior, which has been another area that's been intensely politicized. As a graduate student, I actually participated on a successful grant proposal to study American sexual behavior back in 1990 that was canceled when the contents of the survey were read out on the Senate floor, and they said, you're going to ask who about what?
Right.
But at any rate, this study is the kind of study that that they were worried about, which it showed that teen women were reporting far more oral sex and homosexual sex, lesbian sex, than they had in the past in this, the previous studies. And there was some conjecture that it was because of the increased concern about virginity and pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases, that they were switching in that direction, which, of course, you know, at least with the oral sex, doesn't really help with sexually transmitted diseases, but kind of one of the perverse consequences of perverse social concerns.
Right, and I'm sure that the Christian right doesn't like this research either. And, you know, they also, you know, I don't get to talk in the book about all of the places where the Christian right has its own, quote, science that it sets up in contradiction to mainstream academic science, but I do cover it on evolution, embryonic stem cells, and things like Plan B contraception. And what you're talking about, sexual behaviors, I'm sure that they have their own go-to people on this who will talk about why that study is wrong.
Well, the controversies over abstinence education and their efficacy, that's been one of these areas that's been very politicized.
Right, I've talked about that one as well. And here's the in this case, they're trying to use social science to claim that these abstinence education programs have been shown effective in delaying the onset of sexual activity. And of course, there's no good data for that. There's plenty of good data that the alternative, which is the comprehensive sex ed programs, which teach abstinence but also contraception, should you fail to abstain, as many students will, that these programs have been shown to be effective, but they like to attack those. So again, it's the misuse of science.
I'm speaking with Chris Mooney. He's the author of The Republican War on Science. His blog is at chriscmooney.com. Another aspect of the corporatization of science in the United States has been the touting by right-wing think tanks of alternative models of cost-benefit analysis, mm-hmm. which attempt to minimize the risks of things like carcinogens and put them in the context of other carcinogenic risks, and as well as look at the economic consequences of different kinds of regulation related to arguments on the right that any kind of regulation is a form of taking under the Constitution. So have you looked at that, you know, that kind of law and economics spread throughout the regulatory apparatus? It has a really depressive effect on our ability to regulate.
Oh, yeah, I've looked into it a little bit. I mean, other authors have done more to look into it, and I would recommend the book Priceless by Ackerman and Heinzerling, which looks at basically about how the form of cost-benefit analysis that's being done is rigged or is not valid or reliable. And I find that critique convincing. But it's important to recognize I'm focusing more on the misuse of science than the misuse of economics, although the misuse of economics is certainly prevalent as well. And what you find is that cost-benefit analysis wasn't enough for the business interests. They wanted, in order to stop regulations they didn't like, they wanted to attack them on economic grounds. But my book discusses more specifically the way they've also tried to attack them on scientific grounds. And there's been a whole sort of infrastructure that the Bush administration has now put in place to facilitate those sort of corporate attacks on studies that people don't like because they might cause regulation.
When you look at the overall funding picture of the Bush administration and try to make an argument that the Bush administration is anti-science, you can't actually make it on the basis of funding because the funding, the overall science funding has stayed relatively constant. But there has been a shift in the directions that funding goes.
Relatively constant, although scientists are really increasingly concerned about the 2006 budget, and they feel that basic research is not faring well in this budget. So they have started to raise some alarm about that, but I don't try to make that part of my central argument. And that is for a key reason. I believe that politicians have a right. They've been elected. They have a right to make decisions about what to do with the public's money. And that includes decisions about what scientific research to fund. And that those are inherently policy decisions. What they don't have a right to do is to mislead us, to distort information. And that's where I think the misuse, the politicization of science is really bad right now. So I try not to go as far with the budget arguments because it's complicated. I mean, scientists are always grasping for more money. And, you know, and it's unclear exactly where the line should be drawn. You know, what do we fund, what we don't, what do we not fund? I'm certainly in favor of funding basic research, but there's going to be a line somewhere.
Well, I think that touches on one of the concerns that your book raises for some, those who don't give it a close reading, is that you seem to be endorsing a kind of naive positivism, the notion that all scientists agree that there's a universal scientific method and there's no paradigmatic addictions on the part of scientists and things like that. And you're not actually coming from that point of view.
No. I wouldn't want to be committed to that position because, as you said, it is a little bit naive. And I've actually done my reading in the field of science and technology studies, and I think I reflect a lot of what the conclusions that those scholars have come to. When I sort of set up the argument, I have a chapter called Political Science 101, where I kind of go through these things, and I note that the scientific method does not match the idealized description that scientists would sometimes like to claim that is how they do things, but rather that there's subjectivity involved in the process on a lot of levels, and I think that we should acknowledge that. However, there's politics in the scientific community, of course, there are interpersonal relationships or, you know, fallouts between people. All of these things are happening. It's a human endeavor, and we can't deny that. But that doesn't mean science somehow is not useful or not important, especially to setting policy directions. All you have to grant me is that science, only maybe for pragmatic reasons, we need science to make good decisions. All you have to grant me is that, and then I can make my argument.
So, to paraphrase the argument, politics and ideology and personality all shape the way that science comes out and sometimes distorts the scientific method, but the way to improve all that is to return to the scientific method.
Well, the way to go is to admit that these things happen and that science is an imperfect tool, but nevertheless one of the best tools we have, and to recognize that when the scientific community reaches really strong consensus conclusions, where we're talking about scientists across the world, independent groups all agreeing over time, and conclusions have been thoroughly vetted, then at that point, those conclusions become very powerful. And that's something that we should contradict only at our peril, because especially when it comes to something like global warming, the information and the consensus that has been reached has really important consequences for the decisions that we make.
The reason I think this is a really important part of the argument is that I think it explains why there's so much popular support for things like creation science, because there's a wellspring of suspicion about the aristocratic pretensions that people perceive, and you know, the kind of anti-intellectualism of the American populace towards scientists and intellectuals, and there's a notion that, well, now we've been able to show that you guys have these paradigms, and that you get stuck in your paradigms, and this is just another paradigm. Your evolution is another paradigm, or climate science is another paradigm, and well, that's why we can go over here and believe these guys, because these are the real rebels who are trying to break through your paradigmatic addictions.
Right. They've learned, you know, ironically, the right has learned the language of postmodernism and relativism and employs it selectively so that they can justify their own attacks on mainstream positions. But I'm not going to go with them into this position of extreme relativism, which is what their approach entails, ultimately, which is that there's no credible source of information at all, and that it is all just opinion. And I don't go there. I don't think that that's true or helpful. I think that they're probably misusing the arguments of some scholars who have actually pointed out subjective factors in science, but who nevertheless don't think that science is all opinion, or that there aren't, you know, things that we can discern about reality.
How much utility do you think there is in a process of kind of citizen science panels? It's something that's been experimented with in Denmark and other places, and I don't know very many successful examples in the United States, and I have a kind of innate suspicion of them, because I think I like the idea of a technocratic model where expert panels of real people who know really what they're talking about get together and make decisions. But on the other hand, it does seem to be a legitimation process for things which we have a much harder time with in the United States, when a group of citizens get well-educated in a topic as representatives of the population in Denmark or someplace, and then make a citizens panel recommendation on the basis of their self-education.
Right. Well, I'm certainly not against it. That's something that should be explored. We do have this. I'd like to bridge the gap between the so-called technocrats and the rest of society, if there's a good way to do it. I mean, the good way to do it is not for the technocrats to say, oh, you know, we don't really know anything. what we know is just relative, and it's just as valid as what you know. But I don't think that's true. I think that we have to maintain a respect for expertise, but if there can be better communication, and if something like that would help the understanding of science more generally, I'm all for it.
So intelligent design, another part of your book and another hot, extremely hot topic right now. Your appearance on the Jon Stewart show this last week was in their evolution schmevolution section, which was just hilarious all week. But let's be clear. Intelligent design is actually a much more sophisticated argument than creation science, right?
Is it sophisticated?
You don't think it's sophisticated?
Scientifically, I don't think it's not. I mean, philosophically, some of the things they're doing are slightly more sophisticated. But I think intelligent design is a warmed-over, hoary, old, philosophical chestnut from many centuries ago. And I really think that's about all there is to it,
If you can't explain it.
Something looks complex, and therefore, because we think this is complex, it must have a designer. And the designer must be intelligent. I mean, it's a philosophical, metaphysical argument that we've heard that goes back to well before Darwin. And there's no data that you can use to confirm this argument. And that's really all there is to it. I mean, what's more sophisticated about them, I think, is something else that they do, which is their philosophical, it's not valid, it's not right, but they have their philosophical attack on science itself, which they claim is motivated by materialist or atheist biases.
Well, look, they make the argument, for instance, that when in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, we're listening to all this noise from space, and there's a certain pattern that we're trying to pick out that will have a sufficient degree of patternedness to it that we know that that could not statistically occur just by chance or only one in a trillion times.
Right.
And then we would know that there was an intelligence behind that signal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of argument that they're trying to make about the universe. If we can find some aspect about the universe which is so statistically unlikely, it might indicate intelligent design. That doesn't seem to me to be just, you know, totally unreasonable idea.
Oh, but that's not... Well, there's the intelligent design, and then there's intelligent design. If you're talking about design of the universe, that's one thing. I don't know anyone who's trying to push that into the teaching of schools anyway. If you're talking about the intelligent design as an anti-evolutionary perspective, not about the origin
cosmology
of the universe, but the origin of life, then you're getting into a much, much more controversial area. So, and in terms of their pattern recognition things, you know, I'm familiar with what you're talking about. I mean, they like to point to Mount Rushmore, too, and they say, look, you see the faces, those were clearly designed by some kind of designer, and I agree. But when they bring this to the history of life, and they're looking at bacteria or cellular structures, we don't see anything that's as unequivocally designed as, like, faces. You know, there are no faces on the surface of the cells, for example. And scientists don't agree that the things that they claim are designed, like the bacterial flagellum, they don't agree that these things are so irreducibly complex that they couldn't have evolved. So it's not unequivocally accepted data that they're alleging.
We're looking for God's digital rights management signature there on the genome someplace in the junk part of the DNA. Okay, well, you're really cooking with this, and I suppose you're going to spend another year probably whacking at this, but do you have something new on your horizon? What are you going to work on next?
Well, that is a good question, and there have been many thoughts, but I am unable to go forward with announcing anything at this particular point in time. I mean, frankly, the book has kept me busy, but the hurricane was really a double whammy, and that has really put me off of... figuring out what comes next for me.
Put your partisan hat on, as if you didn't already have it with the Republican War on Science, but put your partisan hat on for a second. I think Katrina, many of the progressives that I talk to think Katrina has finally broken the back of the Republican libertopian ascendancy, and that there is going to be a new wave of support for social welfare state and progressive ideas and whatnot. Do you think that that is a possibility?
Certainly a possibility. We'll have to see how it plays out, you know. I mean, I don't know. You're seeing troubling things in the wake of Katrina, too.
Well, lifting the minimum wage law and the environmental protection laws in order to encourage economic growth in the area, that was the Republicans' first thought.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, you know, these tendencies are still there. But it may really have that big long-term impact. And, you know, I certainly can see it playing out. I mean, it is a big failure of Republican governance. Clearly, although there were also failures at the local level.
I've been speaking with Chris Mooney. He's the author of The Republican War on Science, which is top of the charts in nonfiction in the last couple of weeks. And you can read his blog at chriscmooney.com and pick up the book on Amazon or any other outlet. Thanks so much for joining us, Chris.
Yeah, thanks. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.